Thank you, Amy. Before we get to questions, I want to introduce Ron and Carrie, who are up on stage already. Ron is a carbon market specialist with Environmental Defense Fund out of Washington, D.C. And there he works on strategic greenhouse gas management in three different contexts. In the corporate context, he drives business cost savings through management and mitigation of greenhouse gas emissions with EDF's corporate partners. In the supply chain context, he contributes greenhouse gas management expertise to development of standards through the World Resource Institute, Business Council for Sustainable Development, and you can finish that, Greenhouse Gases Protocol Supply Chain and Product Initiative. It's a mouthful. And in the third context, in carbon offsets, Ron's work focuses on developing a robust and transparent market for high-quality carbon offsets that will help finance the breakthrough emissions reduction projects. He has led EDF's work to screen and identify high-quality carbon offset projects, including those listed on their website at carbonoffsetlist.org. I encourage you to check that out. I was looking at that just last night. We'll talk about it. And his background, he has an MPP from the JFK School of Government at Harvard and a BA in economics from the University of Michigan. So welcome, Ron. Carrie King is a research associate with UT, the Center for International Energy and Environmental Policy at the Jackson School of Geosciences. Carrie studies energy systems, how they work together, how they impact the environment, and how and why humans as a society consume energy resources. And much of his recent work has focused on this nexus between energy and water for projecting water demand for electricity generation, as Amy was discussing, as well as for alternative automobile fuels. Additional work in which Carrie is engaged includes the economics of carbon capture and sequestration, design of beneficial combinations of renewable energy and storage systems, and the creation of tools to help the public and policymakers understand trade-offs among different electricity generation sources. So as we get more strategic about our energy generation, his work will be critical. Carrie came to UT Austin from the private sector. He was director of scientific research at Unipixel Displays, working on flat panel display technology. And he is a former NSF graduate fellow, holds a BS and doctorate from the Department of Mechanical Engineering at UT Austin. Welcome, Carrie. So I have the privilege of first question, and I'm going to invoke that. On cap and trade, I have always understood cap and trade from the example of sulfur dioxide trading, which was the program implemented for power production. And Ron, I'm going to look at you to confirm my understanding of it. But the cap and trade was always explained to me as engaging the market towards solutions, so that the classic example was if one power plant could reduce a ton of sulfur dioxide emissions for $2, and another plant could reduce sulfur dioxide emissions for $3, the difference being the age of their infrastructure or whatever opportunities they had, that they would look at each other and say, well, rather than me spending $3 to reduce a ton, why don't I give you my $3 and you can get 1.5 tons or 2 tons. You get the point that you're making that exchange as a prospect of the cap and trade. Recently, there was some discussion about cap and trade as it relates to the water market, and water may not be a capped industry. And so I want you to first just confirm that economic market description is accurate, and is there a consequence to water not being a capped industry as it relates to the cap and trade program?
So to answer to the first question, you're absolutely right. One of the key features of the cap and trade approach is that you get, from a program standpoint, from a policy standpoint, it's a program that will drive reductions cost effectively, much more cost effectively than an approach where you're prescribing levels. And so SO2 program we're talking about is part of the Clean Air Act of 1990, something that cap and trade, that program is something that our chief economist was key in getting implemented with the first President Bush, and this is a program that's near and dear to Environmental Defense's policies because it's it was proven to reduce the problem faster and cheaper than expected from the other alternatives. And it's true. It's just this idea that there are varying sort of power plants in this case, and their cost of reducing or abating pollutant is going to be there's going to be a wide spectrum. And so you want the guys that are cheap, that have the cheapest way of reducing, to go first. And with climate change, the same principle holds true. And we think it's especially where you're talking about a pollutant that is global. It doesn't matter if you the impact of CO2 or greenhouse gases is the same. Emissions of 1 ton here versus 1 ton in Beijing. And so this fungibility really lends to that cap and trade program, because then you're really talking about, okay, let's you're really talking about a system where you have tons of lots of actors, different costs of abatement. And the idea is quite simple. You create a market so that there's an ability to trade, ability to find the guys that have the cheapest reduction methods. I want to add one other thing about cap and trade. Is not just about driving costs and flexibility. That's what Amy mentioned in the slide. It's, from our perspective, it's also about creating incentives, right? Correct incentives, so that if you have in a broad carbon market, the current legislation, proposals that we're seeing in D.C. are would cover 70 to 80% of the economy in terms of emissions. If you have a broad cap and trade with lots of actors, then there's incentive for economy-wide, there's incentives for entrepreneurs who can come up with better ways of reducing emissions, who can come up with better ways of being more efficient, and they can get rewarded. So it's buying an offset. There's two sides. It's you can credit your reductions against your own footprint. That's a good thing, because you're not always going to be able to reduce in-house. Personally, I fly a lot. I try to reduce that, but everyone wants to go home for Thanksgiving. That often involves getting in the car or getting in the plane. So when you don't have that ability to do it in-house or in the four corners of your company, offset provides that flexibility. But by buying an offset, you're also really rewarding entrepreneurs that are out there in the first place who are going about capping landfills or installing digesters at dairy farms and trying to reduce lower than what would otherwise at lower costs and in through new ways.
Great.
The water industry, I'm not sure how capped it. Maybe Amy has a better answer to.
So I think that it depends on if you look at the water within a water market in and of itself, in which case you would have some trouble with market drivers except under the natural demand. And I think we talked about that a little bit this morning, in that, for example, on the auctions side, there were some pretty interesting number fluctuations based on location and need. So that sort of generates its own sort of market, and will probably increasingly do so as water becomes more sparse. If you look at the price per acre in the Edwards area versus, the Panhandle, it's a pretty significant difference, and there's a reason for that. The cap is the difference, so over the Edwards. So it is sort of an interesting parallel. I think in this scenario, I think that you're able to fall under the, if there were a cap and trade on carbon within the air sector, that would sufficiently sort of put the pressure on the water part of it as part of the larger air market. And the fact that there is this growing scarcity sort of only adds to the value. So you almost get a double benefit if this were to go through, that you would have under a water savings a large water conservation plan, whether it be municipal or industrial user, where you have this sort of sustainability, this extra water that's available And then you also have this bonus of falling underneath the climate or the energy savings cap and trade side.
Yeah. Open up. Any questions?
Let me add one thing on that before the first question comes up. In terms of the carbon and water, looking at sort of the incremental amount of fresh water that a region needs, and options may be an interesting way to convince people not to do desalination if that's considered a local option, because that's one of the more energy-intensive ways to create fresh water. So if there are, the option might be a good way to say, well, let's not do that, because obviously if I use more electricity, then I have more of a carbon impact, and you know, desalination could be perhaps 10 times as much electricity per gallon of water filtered, so that could be an interesting combination there.
Yeah, and I think you probably see that on the power side too, that you actually have that sort of driving your technology choices on the power side for the actual water impact.
Yeah, I was wondering, your map of where the new power plants are proposed or expected to be going in West Texas because of air quality considerations, are there not a considerable transmission losses? I mean, the population centers and densities tend to be not out in West Texas, and I'm wondering, is all that figured in the big equation, all the losses, and is that a, how efficient is it putting all those power plants far from where the actual need is?
I'll start that, and then Terry can get into the engineering details. So the map that I put up is actually existing plants, just to clarify. So I did mention that there's move towards West Texas, so you're right. There's one, a coal plant currently proposed in Sweetwater, which is near Abilene, and there does seem to be some movement towards plants going out in that area. The answer to your question, the short answer is yes, there are transmission losses. However, and Carrie can go into this, there's the, on the books, there's this a plan to build CREZ lines. What does CREZ stand for?
Competitive Renewable Energy Zone.
And basically, it's like a, my understanding is instead of a two-lane highway, it's a six-lane freeway, and which would allow a huge increase in the amount of power that can be transmitted. Those are moving towards West Texas because of the wind capabilities in West Texas and because of the transmission losses that are currently happening because of congestion on the lines, sort of slowing down the amount of additional wind capacity being put into West Texas. So the idea of the CREZ lines is that that would sort of free up that space so that you could have more of a wind influx. The sort of other thing is now there's more transmission capabilities from that region to the regions of population, and so we're hearing that other types of plants are tempted to move out there as well, both for that reason and also presumably to balance out the sort of the wind issue with where the wind blows at night and not necessarily during the day. So that's sort of my understanding of the answer to that. And Carrie can talk more about how much the losses are.
Yeah, transmission losses in ERCOT, and ERCOT is the governing agency, of about 85% of the generation in Texas is about 6 or 7% of electricity generated reaches essentially the end of their substations or close to the end user. The CREZ lines, it's about 6 or 7% is a transmission loss factor you could apply in Texas approximately. I think it's lower than you see in a lot of studies. Try to look at it from a water perspective just as part of our report for the Texas Water Development Board, which some of the numbers quoted in Amy's presentation, so I looked up some of the numbers from ERCOT to, and they have this, these data reported. The CREZ lines are to access, or provide access to about 18 or 19 gigawatts of renewable energy power, essentially, I guess, any power, but renewable energy power right now, there's about 8 or 8.5 gigawatts of wind power in Texas, and that's the most in any state in the U.S. by over a factor of 2 now. So you have the associated water savings with wind power. So the good news is wind power, well, in the sense that the wind power is out in West Texas where there's no water, so you can, and it doesn't need water, so that worked out kind of well. And so it, last year, 2008, wind power was probably about 13 or 14 gigawatt or terawatt hours, so that's about 3.5% or somewhere of the electricity generated in Texas. So that saves accordingly, 3.5% of the average water consumption for power generation. The Texas power plants, if you average them all together, the total generation is about 0.4 gallons every kilowatt hour, or 400 in terms of the units we show up there, 400 gallons for every megawatt hour. That's about the average number for the sort of Texas electricity generation.
Okay. Any other questions? So actually, let's go here in front.
My question is about wind and water. I understand, or I know, that the wind turbine doesn't actually use water to create energy, but I'm trying to figure out, if anybody knows, how much energy is required in the manufacture of the nacelle, of the blades, of the tower, of the concrete for the base that's put in to actually hold this structure straight up and down. I know that steel is very water consumptive during its processing. In your studies, have you found any data on that?
I don't have any numbers on the water associated with making turbines, but I've read many of the reports associated with what they call energy return on energy invested with regard to energy technology. So that is, how much energy does it cost to manufacture through all the processes versus how much energy you get out. People draw different boundaries on that. But for wind turbines, you typically see in the range of 10 to 20. It depends on where you put the wind turbine, say how good the wind resource is, so that's highly influential. So this would be over the life of a wind turbine of, say, 20, 25 years, you estimate you can get 10 to 20 times more energy out than you invested in manufacturing. So manufacturing probably occurs in less than a year, and then you're operating for 20 or 25 years, and then you decommission it, and maybe another year or so. We haven't decommissioned in wind farms, really, so not sure how long that'll take. So it's a measure to figure out how effective an energy technology is, and I'm pursuing some work to try to look into that a little further, because obviously paying back the energy over 20 years, something that took 1 year to manufacture, is a little different time scales. And some people use energy payback time also, like how long does it take to generate as much energy as required to produce the technology. So for wind turbines, that's typically quoted in the 1 year frame, 1 year time frame, sometimes less, sometimes a little more.
Okay. Yeah, I'm very encouraged by the research starting up, and I really think that the water energy nexus is really kind of a really interesting horizon for us. And just wanted to share an experience I've had with the pilot project in California, and either challenge or ask to get some feedback from the effort here. When we first got into it, from a water perspective, there's been some regional water supply projects where multiple agencies get involved and then they share the resource. That's even happened on regional water recycling. From a water efficiency or water conservation, there's kind of other than maybe the Imperial Irrigation District example for Metropolitan Water District, it's kind of a new market also to say, well, could we do regional conservation? So if one utility is saturated in plumbing retrofits and other things, but another utility isn't, could they go invest the low-hanging fruit water conservation elsewhere and reap some of the benefit? And as the water utilities started partnering up with the energy private-owned utilities in California for the pilot, one of the things that was a roadblock was the public interest groups, who were concerned as we started looking at using the public goods charge that is collected to do energy efficiency and start looking at that water-energy nexus. They were resistant to allow those funds to be spent outside of the service area of the IOU. And I'm encouraged that we're going to have to get over that roadblock. So I challenge, as you go forward with your research, try to find some solutions, work with others, and because it will be a win-win, ultimately.
Right. Is Susan still here? No. Because I talked to Susan just before the lunch break exactly about that strategy of urban water districts subsidizing conservation. And she said that there are many examples, but I don't have the details on that.
I would just add that where you're going to get probably the easiest flow through is where you have these both a city municipality providing both the water and the power. So you're gonna have, here in Austin, as part of the Pecan Street project, for those of you who aren't familiar, Austin Energy has started this sort of utility of the future plan. They've partnered with EDF as well as many other corporate partners in University of Texas are now participating. And it's sort of this look at what is it going to look like in the future for an energy provider. And, you know, just as an example, maybe through my constant yelling at the office, water is one of the subgroups. So, but the difference is that Austin has a municipal water utility. So it's a little bit, and I'm not saying that we're not going to come up with roadblocks. I'm sure we are because we have, you know, often different dynamics between the two agencies. But it's a little bit easier in that way versus when, you know, Texas has a deregulated market. So outside of, say, San Antonio and Austin, you're going to have, you know, John Q power provider, and then, you know, this little tiny town water utility giving them their water. And that then becomes, or you have sort of the wholesaler water, which just sort of provides a whole other list of challenges. So I think that we're hoping to, I think, you know, we recognize what you're talking about, and I think that for that reason we're going to try to start in the areas where you have both things located in the same city and they're already in communication with each other, and sort of see if we can't get some traction there and then really move to the bigger challenges.
Yeah, I would say that makes a lot of sense, especially because when we put our heads together, think about offsets in water and how you can drive emission reductions, quantifiable emission reductions, which then can be called offsets or marketed as offsets. You know, one of the roadblocks is that the way carbon accounting is done, there needs to be real clear lines of quantification and tracking and ownership. So if you're talking about reducing energy consumption through conservation programs or efficiency programs in, from the water perspective, and that you're driving reductions in energy, you've got to demonstrate ownership, and if there's a reduction, there's got to be, there can't be double counting, obviously. So there's one reduction, and then the benefits of those reductions, if they're marketed, you know, they can be shared, obviously. There must be some clear line of contracts or ownership so that there isn't double counting.
Questions? I wonder if any of you can comment on desalination co-located at power plants create more water, and also the possibility of using wastewater for cooling at power plants, perhaps having a water treatment plant co-located with the power station.
Sure, I guess I can put in a couple of examples. So the nuclear power plant in Arizona, which I guess competes with the South Texas nuclear project here in terms of who thinks they're bigger, but theirs is completely water from a wastewater treatment facility there, so in the middle of the desert. So it can be done if you want to, and that's nuclear are probably the most, one of the most water-intensive power generation systems, and one of the ones that probably needs it the most securely, given their time requirements for shutting down for anything planned or unplanned. The other question, yeah, desalination in power plants. That could be a good use of the heat energy coming out of power plants, because it's not done a lot here in the U.S. in terms of, at least for industrial processes, and that's one of the few areas it's done. And even here in Texas, some companies, you know, of the last decade tried to take advantage of selling steam to industrial facilities and selling electricity on the grid, and perhaps overbuilt a bit, so they didn't do too well. But that is an area and to look at. For instance, well, Australia has pursued a couple of desalination projects, and that sort of brought up a little uproar in terms of electricity that's used, and that Australia has a very coal-intensive electricity grid. So everybody's like, wait, we signed Kyoto, and now we have this energy-intensive water, freshwater production process, but we can't do this. And so they said, okay, we'll build a wind farm off the coast and make the desalination plant, you know, contract the energy from the wind farm. So that was their little solution. So whether you like that or whether you just want to convince somebody to do a reverse auction or conservation instead of the desalination, well, then that's a discussion for the local region, I guess, of interest to influence their decision makers.
Yeah, and I would just add to that really almost exactly that the regional aspects of all of this is going to just become more and more critical. I mean, on the particular on the using the wastewater side, you just have to make sure, you know, just because it works somewhere doesn't mean, well, we need to build a new power plant here. Well, why don't we just use wastewater? I mean, you really need to look at what the current uses of that wastewater are. I mean, the truth of the matter is that most of our downstream flows going to the, you know, basin estuaries and many of the parts of populated Texas have a large portion of treated wastewater in them. So you just need to make sure that somebody isn't already depending on that water. So, you know, this has become an ongoing conflict in water reuse here in Texas and question of what we're going to allow. But for the most part, you know, if you look at how much water, and we're doing this in the future report, how much water is actually permitted from the surface water and what would happen if everybody used their full permit amount, how dry would it be? And I think, you know, there's sometimes a implied dependency on those wastewater flows as a flow value. So it may work technology-wise, but it may not make sense regional-wise. And so for a lot of these decisions, we need to be moving to more of a regional approach and weighing what the regional options are.